WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
First guest this evening joining us is Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. Welcome back to the program, Governor.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you? Happy New Year. Happy holidays.
Yeah.
You had a good one?
I did. Well, that's my first order of business is to see how the Baker family, how were the holidays for you?
Very nice. We had kids home for some of it. Ours are mostly grown at this point, so we don't get to see them as much as we used to. And we did spend a little time visiting with my in-laws in Connecticut. But all in all, I would call it a big success. We also, my wife and I also got a chance to watch first five episodes of Westworld, which is one hell of a show, man. Wow.
Now, are you a Netflix guy?
Not really. That's Westworld, I think, is HBO.
Okay. All right.
We watched somehow over the course of the summer, we kind of found our way to watch the eight episodes of Stranger Things, which I think was a Netflix series.
Right.
That was pretty wild, too. I'll tell you... As long as you have a pretty big imagination, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on TV these days.
You know, it is very interesting. There's so many different things, and it depends on what you like. If you're somebody who likes The Walking Dead or The Westworld or anything, it seems like everybody, there's so many different things. If you are somebody who likes The Tube or you like some of the stuff, I mean, Netflix has their own productions these days, so definitely very interesting.
Amazon's also got a pretty big... I haven't seen anything on Amazon, but it looks to me like based on the amount of their advertising on regular TV, they have some pretty heavy-duty production activity going on as well.
Yeah, Hulu.
It's just the whole thing is getting, you know, the whole thing with respect to content is getting really interesting.
It's about time.
Yeah.
Well, now, so with the change of the calendar, are you the type of guy who makes New Year's resolutions? Yes, no?
Sometimes. Depends. The big issue there, of course, is if you make one, you better try to actually deliver on it, whatever it might be.
Yeah. So, not somebody who's...
My big resolution, I made more of a professional than a personal one, and my professional one was to see if we can't work pretty hard around here to maintain what I would describe as the character of the political conversation we have here in the Commonwealth. I mean, generally speaking, people aren't afraid to compromise here. People aren't afraid to work across the aisle. People aren't afraid to try and find things they can agree on to move the state forward. If you look at a lot of the stuff we got done in the last legislative session, a lot of it was pretty collaborative. And even on stuff we didn't agree on, you know, nobody questioned anybody's motives or, you know, their character. And I think in some respects it stood as kind of a stark contrast to a lot of what we hear out there is sort of political and policy conversation in other parts of the country. I'm proud of.
And I would ask you, taking a look at the calendar change, looking back at the items and issues in 2016, what are some of the things that are most memorable, whether it was an item, whether it was political, whether it was something that took place, or things that took place at the State House? What were some of the things that you remember about 2016?
Well, on the legislative side, let's start there. I mean, the energy bill, which was a big, complicated hairball that we worked on for 2 years,
right,
and will make it possible for Massachusetts and the rest of New England to create about to create many thousand megawatts of clean power, both through hydropower and wind and onshore and offshore wind. That was a big win, I think, for the region and for Massachusetts. And since we will be decommissioning the Pilgrim plant, and there's thousands of other megawatts around the region that are going offline for one reason or another, this is a pretty good sign that we have the ability to come up with a plan to both reduce our carbon footprint and make sure that we have competitively priced electricity and heat here in Massachusetts and across New England. We also got a terrific economic development bill passed, which gives us the ability to invest side by side with our cities and towns and private businesses and economic growth, literally from one end of the Commonwealth to the other. And that's already started to bear fruit. We awarded about $100 million worth of grants in the fall for all kinds of projects that will probably leverage way over $1 billion worth of activity. We got a pretty decent compromise bill passed to create a regulatory framework for Uber and Lyft, which was something that was really important to the people who both use those services, but also who provide them.
Right.
And we also got a pay equity law passed, which was one of the more significant and important pieces of legislation to reduce some of the intrinsic barriers that women face in the workplace. I mean, we got public records passed, which is
a big thing.
Remember, the media should be important to you.
It is.
And we also got the most, what I think of as the most comprehensive opioid legislation in the country passed, which was, again, done on a bipartisan basis. I think the final version passed unanimously in both the House and the Senate. And we've been working very hard to implement that bill, recognizing that we're climbing up a very steep hill on that issue, given how bad the epidemic is, not just here in Massachusetts, but around the rest of the country.
Well, we know that the opioid epidemic was one of your administration's top priorities upon entering office. What were some of the programs and things that you were able to implement? Because I think there were numerous things throughout the year that you were able to put forth, or that your administration was able to put forth, to at least to try to tackle this issue.
There's all kinds of pieces to it. I mean, it basically breaks down into four categories: prevention, education, intervention, treatment, and recovery.
Right.
On the treatment and recovery side, we've increased state support for treatment and recovery options by about 50% since we took office. Dramatic increases just sort of across the board. As a result, we have far more beds at every level, both detox beds, but also continuing care beds and supportive beds for people who are sort of working their way down what I would call the continuum here. And we've made a very big investment in the outpatient piece as well. On the prevention and education piece, we got pretty comprehensive legislation passed to limit first-time prescriptions for pain meds to 7 days. And people are on long-term chronic pain meds. That's not what this is about. This is about, if you have wisdom teeth out, there's no reason for you to walk out the door with 60 Percocet.
Right.
And I think, based on the data we've seen so far, there's been a pretty significant reduction in first-time prescriptions and the volume of first-time prescriptions for people dealing with, a single acute incident, which is good. We've also had a huge increase in the number of prescribers who are using our prescription monitoring program, which has been totally revamped and now works not just here in Massachusetts, but in conjunction with systems in multiple states in New England, which is great. We also have, for the first time, incorporated pain management as a core requirement to graduate from medical school, dental school, and nursing school here in Massachusetts, and it's become part of the continuing ed requirements for people who want to get their licenses renewed if they write prescriptions. From our point of view, this is really about, let's do some things to get smarter and help prescribers and patients and their families get smarter on the front end. We've also had some very successful interventions on the drug trafficking side, although, the arrival of fentanyl has been kind of a really negative game changer on that one. But we're continuing to work with our colleagues at the federal level and at the local level to try to take some of the really big dealers off the streets. And again, the treatment and recovery piece, we've invested in a pretty significant way at this point. We obviously have a long way to go, and I said at the time when the law got signed that I view this as one of the most negative issues I've ever seen in my life, with just a ton of really awful momentum. And it's going to take us a while to bend the curve on this, but I think we're doing the right kind of thing.
When you talk about fentanyl, is it a matter that it does it need to be tougher laws put in place, or is it a matter of the enforcement of the laws that are already on the books?
Well, I think it speaks to some extent to the recent arrival of fentanyl, that we literally, thanks to the work of the Attorney General and the legislature, Maura Healey and Speaker and the Senate President, we just got, as part of, I would say this is maybe back in March or April, we got a law passed with respect to fentanyl, so that if you're trafficking in fentanyl, it's considered to be a crime. We didn't have a law in the books with respect to fentanyl, because until it started showing up here, it really wasn't on anybody's radar.
Right.
So that law is there, and we've actually had some very significant arrests that have involved people who are trafficking in fentanyl. But that is just an unbelievably dangerous drug if used improperly, and it's like literally 1,000 times more powerful than the heroin, and it comes with all kinds of terrible consequences. And if you look at the, I mean, I hate to say this because it sounds kind of morbid, but if you look at the overdose data, you can see where fentanyl really started to show up in Massachusetts because of the uptick associated with heroin deaths. And fentanyl, because people are mixing fentanyl with heroin, and fentanyl is a much harder overdose for Narcan to actually succeed in bringing somebody back on. And the arrival of fentanyl, as I said, it wasn't even illegal to traffic in it here in Massachusetts until sometime last spring, which should tell you how recent its arrival has been. But it has been a horrible element of the fight against this stuff since it started to show up in a big way last summer.
Something I want to cut you talk about fentanyl, that entering on scene. And I think, you know, causing further issues when we talk about addiction. You look at November, the recreational marijuana ballot passing. Does this passage of recreational marijuana, will this complicate the Commonwealth's efforts when it comes to the addiction problem? Or is it just something, another issue that compounds the problem at this time?
I think, as you know, Kevin, I oppose the...
Right.
I opposed the ballot question primarily because it was written by the marijuana industry for the marijuana industry. And I worried a lot, especially about the edible piece. I mean, you literally have hundreds, if not thousands, of products that look a lot like their traditional
candies and stuff that kids can get their hands on.
Sodas, yeah. Soft drinks,
you
wine.
Name.
I mean, it's beer. It's everywhere. And in Colorado and Washington, from my point of view, and I've read a lot about it. The legislature, actually, state senate, actually sent a group out there to do an on the ground study of it, which was an incredibly helpful document. It's pretty clear that Washington and Colorado are struggling with this, and they admit it. You know, Governor Hickenlooper on 60 Minutes said that he's a pretty accomplished guy. Said that figuring out the regulatory apparatus and implementing it for recreational marijuana in Colorado is the hardest thing he's ever done. So I worry about it, but, you know, the people voted for it. And the legislature recently passed a six-month delay on implementing a bunch of the different elements that will get us the recreational marijuana fully implemented, because there were some concerns that they... And I think we have about public health and public safety and some issues around local control around where these facilities, where these pot shops go. And I know the legislature is going to hold hearings on this and collect data and work pretty hard to try to take that bill and live up to the commitment to the people of Massachusetts to implement it. But at the same time, deal with some of the more egregious elements of the law that were really just written by the industry for the industry.
Yeah, we had the state treasurer on. She had talked about having, you know, putting together that Cannabis Control Commission and what their charge will be, and trying to, you know, put together law, you know, the rules and how folks could be able to get licenses. And I'm surprised we haven't heard more word from communities that are offering a 6-month or a 1-year moratorium until things are figured out as to where and when they could be.
I honestly believe that some of this stuff just falls into the category of until it's upon you. It's not necessarily something you're paying attention to, but the experience we've had in Massachusetts with medical marijuana is kind of instructive. It has been very difficult. You know, we took over a licensing process that was very screwed up on that and got it all straightened out, and have managed to license medical marijuana dispensaries in every county in Massachusetts. But there are a lot of communities in Massachusetts. One of the elements of the law for medical marijuana is to open up a facility in a community, you have to get a letter from the governing body, you know, the board of selectmen, the mayor, the town manager, whatever it happens to be, that says either we don't oppose this facility going in this location or we support this facility going in this location. But the local elected community had to make some kind of statement about this, whatever the, you know, city or town former government was. And it has been very hard for medical marijuana proprietors to get these letters signed. And that just says to me that if that's how local communities feel about the siting and location of medical marijuana dispensaries, I think it speaks loudly that they're going to have a point of view about how they want to handle recreational marijuana dispensaries. Because as a lot of people know, there's more dispensaries in Denver than there are Starbucks and McDonald's. And I think this is going to be, you know, as we get a little further down the road here, there's more visibility about it. People start looking for places to put some of these dispensaries. I think you're going to see a lot of local communities in Massachusetts take advantage of the one of the elements of the law is the ability for a local community to vote on a referendum against having any dispensaries located in their community. And I think you're going to see a bunch of communities come out and do just that.
Definitely, it's an issue that bears watching, and we'll look forward to the days and the weeks and months ahead as that comes. And again, we're speaking with Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, I guess, here on Monday Night Talk. Just a couple more topics. Looking forward, what are some of your goals that you've set this year for the fiscal year 2018 and for 2017?
Well, we're certainly going to continue to work hard to implement a lot of the elements of the opioid statute that we got passed, and we'll add on to that with some additional initiatives that we'll probably talk a little bit more about in the State of the State, more in the budget, both of which will be coming, so we'll be filing at the end of the month.
Right.
We also are going to continue to work on the MBTA. This has been, you know, years and years of neglect with respect to its infrastructure, and at this point we got a team down there that's developed a pretty solid 5-year capital plan. They're going to start spending about $800 million a year, and most of it's going to go to tracks, signals, switches, and infrastructure. And we doubled down on the number of new cars for the Orange Line and the Red Line that are being ordered and will be assembled out in Springfield. But that, you know, there are two big issues with the T. One is kind of the way the place operates. The other is the quality of the infrastructure.
Right.
They're not unrelated. It's getting much better with respect to the way it's operated, which is going to make it possible for us to put money in the ground and actually make some of the investments that probably should have been made previously to modernize this thing. I mean, every time something breaks, Kevin, it's 50 years old.
Yep.
Every time. Sometimes it's 60 or 70 years old. It's incredible to me how long it's been since some of what I would call the basic preventive maintenance on this thing's been done. But that's a big priority as well. And obviously, we're going to continue to work to grow the economy, not just in greater Boston, where things are going pretty well, but around the rest of the state. And I think for all of us in Massachusetts, let's face it, you know, everything starts with how you think things are going economically, not just for the Commonwealth, but for you and your family.
Right.
And that's going to continue to be a big push for us. We're also going to continue to invest in our vocational and technical schools. There's a lot of jobs out there right now waiting to be filled for people who have those kinds of skills, and there's going to be literally thousands of them over the course of the next decade. They're going to come available as a lot of the folks who do that work now retire. So, I mean, I think you're really going to see us focus primarily on what I would call some of those quality of life issues, which is how I think about the opioid stuff and the jobs in the economy, the jobs in the economy issues as well.
Probably the next thing I would ask you, or the next last thing I would ask you, and that is, we've got a new administration coming in down in Washington.
You sure do.
Have a new president. Are you cautiously optimistic as to what this administration is going to have to offer and what they're going to do for the next 4 years?
Yeah, I think I'm a big believer in, you know, giving anybody the benefit of the doubt when they head into a role like this. I feel the same way about, you know, I would feel the same way about that no matter who got the job.
Mm.
And my big hope, of course, is that they do manage to come up with a pretty big infrastructure plan, which they've talked about, that they do manage to do some things that can sort of jumpstart manufacturing and what I would describe as sort of the elements of the economy that have kind of been neglected over the course of the past few years. And I hope that Washington actually figures out how to get along. I mean, it's been long time since they've demonstrated an ability to focus on what they agree on instead of what they don't.
Hmm.
And I think that's bad for the country, and I think for a lot of people, it sends a bad message, it sends a bad product back to the people back home. And I would love to see Washington take on some of what I would describe as a sort of proactive and positive attitude that people around here have been able to demonstrate to one another with respect to how we try and make policy and find ways to agree.
Amen. Couldn't have said it better myself. 2016 was kind of a tough year when it came to celebrity deaths, especially musicians. And I know you're a guy who loves music. Was there a particular individual who passed that when you heard about it, you reflect, you're like, wow, I can't believe that, you know, so-and-so is no longer with us?
Well, I just turned 60 in November myself, right? So I'm paying a little more attention to this stuff than I ever used to. But certainly Prince was kind of a shocker because I always thought, I mean, I'd always read that he was kind of a health nut.
Yep.
He's a little younger than me, and that one kind of came out of nowhere. And obviously I grew up with a lot of his music. But you're right. There were, you know, the two guys from the Eagles.
Yeah.
Just an incredibly wonderful and amazing part of my youth.
David Bowie. Oh, my God.
A star. And an incredibly creative performer in so many ways. You know, went through multiple phases with respect to both his music and sort of the way he presented himself and the way he performed. You know, I mean, if you're my age, you know, for your listening audience, anybody over the age of sort of 55 or so probably remembers Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Yep.
You know, I'm going way back now, but that was an album unlike any other when it came out back then. And I think some of it, to tell you the truth, is you know, remember, the baby boomers at this point are somewhere between the ages of 70 and 50.
Yep.
Right. So you're going to start seeing, I hate to say this, but you're going to start seeing, you know, this is probably going to happen every year, right, now on end, because you got all these people who were sort of part of this big change, the 60s and the 70s here in this country in so many ways. And they're all getting to the point where they're getting up there in age, and I think this is going to be, I think each year, guys, I don't know how old you are, Kevin, but
I'm 50.
You know, for me, I'm going to see a lot of the people who are part of my youth pass away. And it's going to kind of stink a little.
Yeah, well, I'm 50, so I'm kind of in that realm. So
yeah, right. You're on the exact back end of the.
Yep.
You're right on the edge of the baby boom crowd. Yep.
It is what it is, but I wanted you to at least have an opportunity to kind of address that, again, knowing that you and I have talked about music from time to time when we've had you on, so I want to give you a moment to talk about that. I want to thank you very much for taking a few moments out of your busy day to join us and talk about some of the things, talk about 2016 in retrospect and some of the things moving forward. And we'll definitely look forward to having you back on in the near future.
I look forward to it, Kevin. And obviously on the 14th of January, I'll be plopped in front of my television watching the New England Patriots rock and roll their way to another Super Bowl.
No matter who it is.
Exactly.
No matter who it is, we'll
exactly.
go right through them.
Okay.
Listen, have yourself a great evening.
You too, Kevin. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, there he is. Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, our very first guest here on Monday Night Talk. Great way to kick off the program, as we'll look forward to having the governor on probably a couple more times in 2017. Hopefully we can talk to him after the release of the 2018 budget and get an idea as to what the thought process was for the new spending plan. We are going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Peter, it was always Tiny's intention to have a Tiny and Sons business.
That's true, that's true. We always worked well together, but my mom had a lot to do with it. I think she wanted us out of the house. She really needed her peace and quiet.
Five kids, you really can't blame her.
Tiny taught us how to get along and work together. And most important, Mother knows best.
Did you learn anything about windshields?
That too, but you really get used to doing a good job. You know Tiny's gonna check it out.
My boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, and once again we thank Governor Charlie Baker for being our guest on that last segment. Of course, hope to hear from him once the budget comes out. That'll be something that we'd look forward to hearing back from him, depending on what he ends up putting forth for fiscal year 2018. Well, joining us on the phone line right now, we have Ken Weber. Ken is with Recovering Champions. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Now, from what I understand, you are the forum organizer for an event that's going to be taking place this Wednesday night at the Plymouth Memorial Hall. And this will center on the whole issue of legalizing marijuana, where we've just had the law go into effect as of December 15th. Folks can grow their own plants, recreational marijuana. We know that there's been a little bit of a moratorium put on the licenses of selling marijuana, recreational marijuana. Talk to me about putting together this forum and some of the things that you'll look to discuss during it.
Sure. I guess first, Kevin, I'm the CEO of Recovering Champions, and we are a substance abuse addiction treatment center in Falmouth, Massachusetts. So we probably have a very different take on the legalization of marijuana.
Sure.
And the whole idea was to bring forward some policymakers and some other folks to talk about impacts that we have seen through our work in addiction recovery. And then also, you know, to talk about other states that have gone before us and what's happened there. So, you know, Wednesday night we're bringing together State Senator Vinny DiMacedo, Sheriff Joe McDonald. We'll have one of our clinicians there, and Peter Monahan from Clean Slate. So we really hope to have a good crowd and a lot of discussion around the impacts of this legalization.
Well, I had a chance during that last segment to ask the governor about, you know, legalizing marijuana, recreational marijuana, and his thoughts on it. And I don't know if you had a chance to hear the segment, but I mean, it's something that they're trying to tackle right now, you know, on top of dealing with the opioid epidemic, the crisis, trying to get treatment for folks, trying to get education out there, trying to deal with fentanyl that has been introduced into this, you know, ongoing fight to help folks who are addicted to opioids.
we found in our work that many, many people who end up using opioids start with alcohol and marijuana. It just ends up being a gateway to other, you know, harder, more dangerous substances than those. But, you know, even in itself, marijuana is dangerous. You know, in Washington State, since 2014, AAA Foundation did a study of traffic safety, and there's a 17% increase in drug driving fatal crashes. You know, that's not something to be ignored.
Right.
The other thing, too, is that this is just going to create more access for younger people and younger kids getting into these drugs earlier on has shown, you know, a bad chain of events that ends up being addiction and into other substances.
I find it interesting that you mentioned both alcohol and marijuana as gateway drugs. When I've brought up the conversation, we've had many a conversation about it. Folks, depending on what side of the fence, some folks feel that alcohol is more so a gateway to the opioid epidemic, folks getting addicted to heroin and harder drugs like that. Some will say marijuana is also. Why do you feel? Why is it the conversation that you're talking about here that it's both of those? Is this through talking with clinicians and working with experts that that's the thought process?
Yes, that and just the availability of alcohol, and you know, now even more so pot. It's available for people and easier to get than initially, you know, pain medication prescriptions and then heroin. You know, you mentioned fentanyl. There's another drug now being introduced into heroin, and it's carfentanil.
Right.
And, you know, two small grains of that, perhaps a little bit smaller than salt grains, is enough to take down an elephant. And, you know, first responders are now going to scenes of overdoses, and they're potentially being exposed to this sort of thing. And it's creating some struggles there.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because our managing news editor, Christine James, had a similar conversation with the Plymouth County District Attorney, Tim Cruz, and mentioning the carfentanil and it being a something to tranquilize or bring down an elephant. And I've had a chance. I know many of folks who work, whether they're police or firefighters or EMTs. And, you know, introduced not too long ago was Narcan, the way to be able to revive folks and help folks. But from what I'm understanding is that with the introduction of fentanyl and the carfentanil, that it's getting harder and harder to revive folks with the Narcan.
That's correct. Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
What is becoming of our culture that you know, that we're seeing, we can't tackle the one issue, that there's something that's even stronger that's introduced that makes the fight harder to flank?
Yeah, you know, culturally, not quite sure. I mean, we do know, and the legislators done a good job with the overprescribing of opioids. So we do know that, you know, that has led to this epidemic as well. So they've done a good job, you know, socially restricting that, making sure the doctors are not over prescribing it. But I don't know really what's driving socially to it. Certainly, you know, when someone becomes addicted to an opioid prescription, it's much easier after time goes on to buy heroin. It's much cheaper and much easier to get, and so that's why we find people, you know, moving to that substance. And then as soon as that happens, then you are exposed to fentanyl and carfentanil.
Right. Again, we're speaking with Ken Weber. He is with Recovering Champions. Ken, if you will, before we wrap up the segment, give folks a little bit of an insight into what it is that Recovering Champions looks to do and where you guys have locations.
Sure. So we really look at addiction individually. Very proud to say that we have master's level licensed therapists leading our groups and dealing with people on an individual basis. Many of our therapists are in long-term recovery themselves. you know, where we see this addiction, we really see, you know, hope and freedom for people. We work every day to do that. Many folks who work for us are in long-term recovery, and there's no connection like that. You know, there's no connection to another person struggling with addiction than someone who has overcome that. And that's really what we're all about, is to bring that repair back to families and help people to get into recovery, because recovery itself is really pretty amazing. You know, there's a lot on the news about addiction, and, you know, woman who passed out with her 2-year-old daughter there. We're really about promoting recovery, and that is attainable for people. And that's a really beautiful thing when families can recover together.
And again, this is your chance to just kind of get the word out there about this event that's coming up this Wednesday night, 7 p.m., Plymouth Memorial Hall. You're attempting to bring community leaders together, folks. You're inviting folks in free of charge. I understand space is limited, so folks should make sure they get there early so they can get a seat for this. Give them the details of the conversation that will take place on Wednesday.
The conversation's just going to revolve around the risks ahead with the legalization of marijuana. There's a flyer on our website, recoveringchampions.com, and there's more details out there with specifics. And, you know, we would just invite folks to come and participate.
Ken, I want to thank you very much for calling in, giving folks a little bit of a preview of this, and let's definitely make sure we have you back on the program to discuss the issue and maybe even promote further what you guys do, and maybe any events that you got coming up, just to spread the awareness about addiction and what you guys do.
Kevin, thank you so much for that.
You got it. There he is, Mr. Ken Weber with the Recovering Champions, talking a little bit about that forum that's going to be coming up this Wednesday night at 7 p.m. It's from 7 p.m. to 8:30. More information, recoveringchampions.com. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, second hour of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com, the South Shore's news, weather, and traffic station.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, Chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
David Ortiz runs a charitable golf tournament in Punta Cana, La República Dominicana, every year. He hires La Artista to make a cigar blended by himself for the golfers in the tournament. Poppy likes it so much, he continues to have it made so his friends and family can enjoy his cigar year-round. It's so good, David Ortiz has made his own brand called Big Poppy, and Brennan Smoke Shop has it. We're so excited to bring you this cigar from a man who has given so much of himself to not only you and me, but also La República Dominicana with his charity. This holiday season, we implore you to bring Big Poppy into your home and celebrate Dominican style. Don't even bother looking for this cigar online. It's retailer only. Big Poppy Cigars, brought to the South Shore and South Coast by none other than Brennan Smoke Shop. Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton. Trust me, this cigar's good, dude.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And as we like to do at this time of year, we get an opportunity to speak with some of our local leaders. We've had state reps, state senators, and joining us now is the mayor of Brockton. He's been on this program many a time. Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter joining us. Good evening, Mayor. How are you?
Kevin, good evening. Great to be back with you.
You know, it's 2017, and a lot happened in not only in the Commonwealth, but in your very city of nearly 100,000 people. If I was to ask you just to kind of cherry pick one or two different items that you felt were kind of the top things that your administration dealt with in 2016, what would you say would be the a couple of the top ones?
Well, geez, it's only a two-hour show, Kevin, right?
I know.
I don't know if I can get to all of them, but, I mean, certainly, you know, in the course of a year, all cities, Brockton included, face a number of challenges. I think what I've learned in my almost 3 years as mayor now is to expect the unexpected, and as soon as you begin to think you know what you're dealing with, there's always a new challenge. So, you know, certainly I think something that resonates in Brockton, that resonates throughout your listening area, is our continuing efforts to deal with the opiate addiction crisis. And in many ways, Brockton is at the epicenter of that here in Metro South, just because of the fact, you know, that we house so many of the facilities and institutions that tend to attract folks that are struggling. We've got two courthouses here in Brockton. We've got two hospital emergency rooms here. We've got two methadone treatment centers here. We've got a whole slew, an array of social service agencies and a neighborhood health center. So I think that clearly, you know, the opiate addiction crisis is not just regional. It's New England. It's national. But southeastern Massachusetts, throughout your listening area, has been hit very hard. So I think the really positive development of the past year was our opening of the Champion Plan, Brockton's version of police-assisted recovery, where any individual can walk into the Brockton police station seeking help for addiction treatment, any type of drug, alcohol, or any type of drug. And rather than being arrested, we kick off the Champion Plan, and within about 15 minutes, we've got volunteers there at the police station who bring the individual to a safe haven and then assist them in getting into a treatment bed, which we know is such a huge challenge. And we've been in business for about 10 months now, Kevin. We've already placed over 300 individuals into overnight treatment. And I think it's a testament to the size and the scope of this problem that we're facing, but I do also believe we're changing lives and we're changing attitudes. I think that our police officers view folks struggling with addiction differently than maybe they did a year ago, and I think at the same token, you know, many people struggling with addiction have had a negative experience with the police department, and it's changing their perception that you do walk in and actually find people who care about you, who help you get into treatment, because we all understand, I think, at this point, that addiction is a public health crisis. It's not a criminal justice system issue. It's a public health issue, and people are dying throughout southeastern Mass, throughout your listening area.
Yep.
And I do really believe that we've had so much impact with this, Kevin. About a month and a half ago, I was invited to present on the Champion Plan at the National League of Cities annual conference in Pittsburgh.
Wow, that's large.
And presented to, you know, mayors and city officials from across the country, because that's the kind of recognition we're getting for what we're doing here. And you know, this is evolving, and we're going to continue to expand and improve and work with the communities around us. So I think there are a lot of issues in which Brockton wants to be a good neighbor and wants to work cooperatively, you know, with the suburbs. And I think certainly, you know, what used to be the mayor's task force is now a regional task force, including several of the towns around us.
If I could stay on the subject just for a half a second longer, we had the district attorney Tim Cruz in here last week speaking with Christine James, talking about the epidemic, and we know that it isn't just the opioids, but now it enters into this, are a couple of other things that I think make the fight, you know what, it's instead of us being able to figure out what's going on and try to get people help and get education out there so we don't have other people who are becoming addicted, you're having things like fentanyl. And I'm understanding that there's a stronger substance than fentanyl, almost like an elephant tranquilizer, that is out there as well. And let's not forget that as of December 15th, folks can start growing marijuana plants. And we're going to be talking about people opening up pot shops to sell recreational marijuana. How, as a mayor, as somebody who is a leader of a community, do you look at these issues as you're trying to battle one item or you're trying to tackle one issue that other things are being thrown in as you're trying to get reinforcements and flank this problem?
Yeah, you hit several hot buttons.
I know.
I'll try to touch them as quickly as I can. Despite the fact that I went to college in the early 70s, I did not support the recreational marijuana law.
No, Bill Clinton.
I don't think it's good policy. I felt as though we really should take our time, take another 2 or 3 years. Let's get medical marijuana fully implemented, have an opportunity to really see where we're going with that, and then maybe consider going on to the, you know, recreational. But, the voters have spoken, so now we'll deal with the law. I just hope that there's a significant tax on it that is earmarked to providing treatment services for people struggling with any type of addiction, because they're going to make millions and billions of dollars selling legal weed. I think they could put a few pennies out of each dollar back into our treatment system that's desperately underfunded, understaffed. The supply is way far short of the demand right now. In terms of our overall battle, I mean, fentanyl, clearly in my mind right now, is the biggest of the threats in our drug raids. We've made some major raids of confiscation of quantities of fentanyl. It seems to be primarily originating in China, and this inexpensive, deadly Chinese fentanyl is just flooded into our area, and we're actually really targeting dealers that, if we know a dealer is distributing fentanyl, they get every bit of attention and resource that we can to try to get them raided and locked up. So fentanyl is a huge challenge. But since former Chief Hayden and I started together almost 3 years ago, we've said consistently that our approach here in Brockton would be to apply this, attack this from both the supply side and the demand side. So while we are compassionately trying to help as many individuals get into treatment programs as we can, we have stepped up the fight against drug dealers. Each year we surpass the previous year's record for the number of search and entry warrants that we're executing. Every single one of those warrants represents several months of investigation by detectives. We know that illegal guns and drugs are tied together and you can't separate them. Drug dealers have guns, gang members sell drugs. And so we believe the reasons why it's such a good investment with these drug investigations is that we're quite often also able to get illegal guns off the street. So, I mean, we are coming at the dealers and the gangs hard with every resource we can get while we are still trying to help individuals. And in a very recent development, you know, we're certainly disappointed with the governor's decision this year to substantially cut the EOPS public safety staffing grant to Brockton that we received $350,000 towards police overtime last year, and that was cut to only $100,000 this year. And that's just a huge hit for us. We don't have an extra $250,000 laying around. And that overtime not only pays for minimum staffing to keep enough patrol officers on the street, but it pays our detectives overtime to conduct these long-term investigations so that we can go after the real dealers and distributors and get some of the real bad guys off the street. And I think we've shown for the past couple years that our stepped-up efforts in working with the DA. The DA has certainly been a great partner to us here in the city of Brockton. combining resources and intelligence, but also with multiple federal law enforcement agencies, with the Plymouth County Sheriff, you know, using multi-level, multi-jurisdictional investigations where we can share resources and share intelligence to target targets of mutual interest. And, you know, we have reduced gun violence in this city. Our gun violence for this past year is over 30% lower than it was 3 years ago when I took office. We've only had two homicides last year. That's the lowest total in 14 years, the second time in only over 40 years that we've had two or less homicides. So we don't believe that's by accident. We really do believe that while that's not the best statistic in the world, I think that it's clearly an indicator that we are, the strategies that we are employing are having some success, and we are reducing gun violence in the city.
We know that some of the things that you've done since taking office is you've always looked to economic development and new ways outside of the box to try to bring monies, tax dollars onto the tax rolls. One of the things was to see if there was a way to bring a casino to the city. That, unfortunately, was turned aside by the Gaming Commission, as well as trying to get more money for education. And then we see a charter school be approved. Give me your thoughts on not only working towards to try to get economic development and bring in new ways, like bring a casino that's going to generate a lot of money annually, but then also have on the backside of things, you're trying to improve education. Education is a big thing. It's a cornerstone in your community, and that your schools have been lauded for being how well they educate those who go into onto higher education.
Yeah, we had the U.S. Ambassador to Cape Verde here with us earlier today, Kevin, and he asked to visit a couple of our schools because of the things that he had read about the Brockton Public Schools, and obviously from his standpoint, some of the great work we're doing with children that are emigrating from Cape Verde to Brockton, and our efforts to get these children proficient in English as quickly as we can, because we know that's their key to success. But the budget, the financial, we look forward to the challenges of 2017, you know, along with the ongoing fight against the opioid crisis. Certainly, I think Brockton is facing a financial crisis. This upcoming budget will be by far the most challenging of the four budgets I will have done at that point. We were hit a couple months ago with a huge increase in our assessment for pension costs from the Brockton Retirement Board. They bumped us up by $5 million a year. That $5 million increase goes right into the upcoming budget. And quite frankly, I don't know where we begin to find $5 million to cover that increased cost of pensions. So that in and of itself will create a huge financial strain on the city in the upcoming year. And clearly, you know, we're disappointed in the way that the state last year handled Chapter 70 funding for public education. And I guess, you know, that's an area where, you know, many of the towns in your listening area would take a different viewpoint than the city of Brockton does. But, you know, we feel very strongly that poor urban gateway cities like Brockton face many more challenges than many of our counterparts in the suburbs. These challenges are expensive. We have over 500 children in our public school system that are classified as homeless. Those kids bring a whole unique set of challenges and trauma with them, and we embrace those children. We love them, and we're giving them a first-class education, but it's a lot more expensive per student than the average. You know, we have children living in poverty. We have children learning how to read and write English. So the challenges are huge here in a public school system like Brockton, and we overcome those challenges. And as you said, we have a level one high school here in the city of Brockton, the only gateway city with a level one high school. And, you know, we're producing young people that are going on to great things every year, and many of them have overcome a lot of challenges to get there. But I don't know how we're going to continue to do that without adequate funding from the state. You know, cities like Brockton are heavily dependent on state aid to local education. And I believe it's the law. Not only is it the right thing to do, but it is the law that every child in this state deserves equal access to a first-class public school education, and the quality of your education should not depend upon your zip code. And unfortunately, I think in the last year or two, there has been a disparity in the funding, and I think that certainly in the upcoming year, the city of Brockton, the superintendent, and the school committee are looking at their legal options in terms of perhaps litigation against the state in equity and education lawsuit.
More or less an update to the Ed Reform Act of 1993.
Right, which had a great positive impact for many years, but now with the way the Chapter 70 formula is being calculated and being applied, with a lot of the takeaways that have occurred, we were essentially level funded for education last year, flat funded. But everyone knows that, you know, all school systems had about a 5% annual increase in cost. So that's a deficit in a city like Brockton of almost $10 million built in before we even start. So, you know, the financial challenges for the city are huge. But, you know, Kevin, we know the real long-term answers, and you alluded to it, is economic development and growth. We have to grow the tax base. And we have had great growth. The last two combined years here in the city is the largest two-year period of new growth in the tax base in the history of the city. So we are growing, and we're doing it despite the fact that nonprofits have bought up a lot of our commercial tax base and had those properties go tax-exempt. But we've got a great economic development team. We are going full steam ahead with an exciting downtown action strategy to revitalize our downtown. We're investing in infrastructure, and we see nothing but a bright future for the city of Brockton.
Being an elected leader, it's usually not easy, and it depends with a city like Brockton, where you've got its strong mayor, weak council. It differs every election cycle as the new faces that are on the city council, somebody who might be elected as mayor. How would you say your relationship with the city council has been in 2016 compared to prior years?
Well, first of all, I think that this people's description of a Plan B form of city government is very misleading. I think there are some councilors that like to say strong council, weak mayor. That's not really the model we have. The weak mayor model is what you have in Cambridge and Lowell,
right,
where the city council elects a mayor from amongst their own members, and that mayor does not have a whole lot of authority other than overseeing the school committee. You know, here in the city of Brockton, the mayor is the CEO of the city.
Right.
The mayor runs the city on a day-to-day basis. The mayor is the chief executive officer, formulates the budget. But certainly, as it should be, we have a series of checks and balances, just like the federal government does.
Right.
So I can't spend money without, an appropriation being approved by the city council. Ultimately, they hold the checkbook, but nor can they. They can't spend any money without the mayor appropriating it first. They can only cut money from the budget. So, you know, I think we have really a pretty good system, a pretty healthy set of checks and balances. The politics get in the way. There's no doubt about it, and I think that it may not change during my administration as mayor, but I do not think the two-year term for a mayor is good government, and having every single city councilor and the mayor constantly on a two-year election cycle, and particularly with the mayor, who's the CEO, it's not a very common model when you get away from New England, and even here in Massachusetts. I mean, Boston is a four-year term. Many of the major cities are four-year terms. So I think it's hard as the CEO and to always make really good long-term decisions when you're constantly up for re-election, when quite often those long-term decisions, you know, are going to inflict some short-term pain. And if you're constantly up for election every 6 to 12 months, it's hard to self-inflict pain. We've done it. We've established a 10-year economic development plan for the city. We are getting ready to launch a facilities master plan of for the city, something that's never been done. And for the first time in decades, we are already working on the blueprint for Brockton, which is a comprehensive master plan for the city, so that we don't have spot zoning and so that we can develop the types of uses in the parts of the cities where they make most sense, and probably most importantly, improve and preserve the quality of life in our residential neighborhoods. So I think we have embarked down a path of some real solid long-term planning, mm-hmm. but it requires a mayor to stay in office for a few years to be able to make it happen. And that's why I'm hoping to stick around a little bit longer, because I think we've initiated some great plans and we're doing some great work. But we need some stability in the mayor's office to see those things through to completion.
I think, I'm not sure, and I'll have to check this, but I think Brockton might be the last of the South Shore communities to have the two-year term, because I think Quincy and Weymouth, or Quincy and Braintree might have changed the model now to 4 years, right?
Yeah, I know Quincy is definitely a
right.
four.
Tom Koch
they
now
made
is
that
a four,
change
right.
a couple of years ago. Braintree is fairly new as a mayor. I think Mayor Sullivan has a four-year term. I think it's a direction we've got to go, and I'll tell you, Kevin, this is so important. I mean, clearly, right now, I think with the current city council, with me as the mayor, I don't see a four-year term anywhere in the horizon. But I'll tell you this, if I am fortunate enough to remain in office long enough to know when my final term is going to be before it happens, I think my number one goal in a final term as mayor would be to use that as an opportunity, knowing that the seat would be coming open in the next election, to really work hard with our city council and our state legislative delegation to change the charter here in Brockton. Because I think it's that important, and I think that the realistic time, the opportune time to make that change would be if you had an incumbent mayor that took an announcement or a pledge that he or she would not be running for re-election. I think that would then, with an open seat coming up, would present a set of circumstances where I think you could get the cooperation amongst all the branches of government to get a charter change through.
Well, it's funny because, again, we were talking about an election year for the city of Brockton, which should get underway any time now, knowing that later this year we will have a preliminary and an election in the city of Brockton. So,
well, it is, and this is the nature of the two-year term, is it just seems like 50% of your term is an election year, and yep. I just don't see how that's good government. And as you say, we're in January now. This is the odd year. This is an election year, and certainly we haven't made any formal announcements or campaigning yet. But by spring, that will happen, and certainly a certain amount of my time and focus and attention will have to be devoted to a campaign for 6 months while still continuing to lead the city, and it's. It's a challenge, but it's a challenge I look forward to.
What kind of energy, does that take to be, people I don't think realize, being the CEO of the city and then having to not only do your job, and your job is not, it's not an 8-to-5 job. You have admitted on this program several times that, God, there must be more than 24 hours a day because you seem like you're on the job all the time.
It does, and it is a high, to do the job properly, it is a high energy job.
Right.
It's at least my approach to it is to be up and working very early in the morning and rarely get home before 9 or 10 at night, and always be on call for public safety and emergency situations. And it is demanding. I love the challenge. I know I've still got the energy. It's a running joke here in the office. I have a couple of young guys who are on the mayor's staff here that when you add their two ages together, they're still younger than me. and I tell them that I'm not going to consider retiring until the day comes that they can keep up with me. And so long as they can't keep up with me, I figure I've still got plenty of energy to take on the challenge.
Speaking of young guys, I know that Bob Buckley, there's been a change in your chief of staff. How has the transition been between Bob and Darren?
Yeah, these things happen from administration to administration.
Yep.
I think it's quite, common in mayor's administrations, for personnel changes to take place. For folks that know Bob Buckley, my former chief of staff, Bob was a career school teacher who took a leave of absence from the public schools to serve his chief of staff, and when he came in with me 3 years ago, you know, he made a two-year commitment to me, and he stayed for over 2.5 years. So, I mean, I think that, you know, Bob actually stayed longer than I could have hoped for. And, you know, I certainly miss Bob, but, you know, Darren Duarte is a great guy to have around, and I was very fortunate to get a guy like Darren who has worked in the electronic media for most of his professional career and has traveled all around the country working as a TV news reporter, a news anchor, and certainly prior to that was a longtime host, TV host and news reporter on Channel 2 in Boston.
Yep.
So, you know, to get a guy like Darren who grew up here in the city of Brockton and who has come back to Brockton at this point in his life and brings this great communications background with him, I think in today's day and age, where we deal with instant information and the internet and social media, I think that any good chief of staff has got to have good communication skills, and that's really what drew me to Darren, besides the fact he's an extremely bright and extremely likable guy. I think the only job in this building tougher than the mayor's job is the mayor's chief of staff's job, because you know, that person has to deal with everything I deal with, plus the other 50% of the stuff that didn't get past them into my office. So it's a challenging job, and we're excited to have Darren on board. We've made a couple changes in our team and in our second administration, and you know, it's always evolving. We're always looking to improve, and I think that you know, certainly with 3 years experience under our belt now, I think we've, you know, been able to continue to improve.
Hey, like any championship team, you know, the 2013 Boston Red Sox were nothing like the 2007 Boston Red Sox, correct?
Yeah, and I think you're looking for common denominators, and and you're looking for certain qualities in people on your team. And I also like to think that we've created some opportunities for some folks, you know, and they've been able to, you know, use their time, you know, working very hard for us here in the mayor's office to, you know, to advance in their own career. And I think that whenever this is all over and I have a chance to look back on my time as mayor, I think having helped some folks advance in their own careers by providing opportunities will be, I think, one of the more rewarding things I'll look back at. But I'm not quite ready to start looking back yet.
Okay, we're speaking with the Brockton Mayor, Bill Carpenter, who's been our guest for this particular segment. Mayor, last question closing out our segment. Do you have a chance to set any goals for 2017, whether they're personal goals or goals for your administration for the city of Brockton?
Yeah, I mean, we're focused on jobs, we're focused on education, and we're focused on clean and safe neighborhoods. And I think those have been goals since the day we got here. We know that they're ongoing goals, but I think that we're making progress in all of those areas. Our real estate market here in Brockton has certainly heated up considerably. I believe that Brockton really has something to offer for market rate housing for folks that are looking to live a 30-minute commuter rail ride out of South Station. So, I mean, I'm really excited about the future. I believe that Brockton, we're on a path to becoming a 21st-century city. We're a city of opportunity. We're developing opportunity for our young people who grew up here. We're providing opportunities for people to own their own home or start their own business. We're providing opportunities for people who come here from somewhere else. And I really believe as we see what American cities will look like in the 21st century, Brockton is uniquely positioned to be a leader, and that's where we're going.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us for this segment. Anything you want to say in closing?
No, great. Kevin, Happy New Year to you and everyone at WATD. And I look forward to being with you again sometime in the near future. And, you know, for folks, I just had this conversation with someone out over the weekend. You know, I'm a Marshfield native, so not many people realize that the mayor of the city of Brockton graduated from Marshfield High School, and my dad is still in Marshfield. So I certainly still have close ties to Marshfield and the South Shore. And I think one of the things we've really tried to do during our time here is work cooperatively with our neighbors in the Metro South area, embarking on projects like a recent agreement we entered into with the town of Abington to provide them with an additional sewer capacity that's going to unlock development in Abington. So, you know, we want to be a good neighbor. I think historically, if you're out in any of the towns in Metro South, as Brockton goes, Plymouth County and Metro South go. And I think that we have a lot of mutual interest, and we look forward to continuing to work with our neighbors in the upcoming year, Kevin.
There he is, Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter, our guest during this portion of Monday Night Talk. We're going to step aside for a few moments. When we come back, more program right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Back for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Thank you for staying with us this long. Of course, top of the hour, South Shore Live. Stan and the gang will be herding themselves in here, and they have a fantastic guest for the first hour. Second hour, I believe, is usually a musical guest. I forget the name of the stage or the hour, but Stan Blackburn and the gang. Stay tuned for South Shore Live coming up at 8 o'clock. And as far as this particular program, something, it was a segment or something, or you get ideas for future topics, you know, we shoot an email to mondaynighttalk@gmail.com. And in the new year, we've been a little bit more diligent in getting the show up more or less in its entirety, instead of kind of breaking it up into segmented podcasts. What we do now is it's the whole show. We just take out the advertising. We take that all out. It's just kind of, yeah, I know. Shame for shame. You know, people were asking, you know, can you get it up quicker? And it's a long process to kind of cut it up, and you know, the individual pictures. Now it's, you know, we get, it's easier. So feel free to kind of weigh in on that. Just a quick note, coming up on January 23rd, we take the show on the road as we head to the Kingston Council on Aging for the evening. Stay tuned for more details next week, as I know Larry's looking at me going, what is this that you say? That's the word. We did the January 23rd. That's what we're looking to do. So stay tuned for that. Well, we turn our attention, our focus, to our next guest. And he's no stranger, although the young lady with him is somewhat of a stranger. She's never been on the air on this particular program. I'm talking about Kevin Lowney. He is with the Milton Players.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah, and he's here. And he's here to talk theater. I was going to talk a little bit with him about the Golden Globes, but
I'm a busy man.
He's a busy guy, and
I got places to be, things to do. I got a play coming up, Kevin.
Yeah,
and you expected me to sit around watching the Golden Globes last night.
Well, being a guy, somebody who's into theater and, you know, performing.
Oh, sure.
That you'd want to see some of the peers in the bigger stage.
I'm not against the Golden Globes. I had rehearsal, man. I got this thing coming up.
Okay. Well, now, who did you bring with you?
This is middle daughter, Devin. Devin, say hi.
Hey.
You can get a little closer. That's good. There we go. Hi. So, so Devin is, the Milton Players, real quick, not to get around backwards, but has been around for like 84 years now. And we have several multi-generational families that have participated in the
and
group.
Poor Devin is
poor Devin is the latest.
She's the latest to join the troop.
Exactly. Well, more or less. Devin is my tech daughter. Her older sister, Katie, has been on stage in several plays and has helped build several sets. And Devin has been around helping build sets a lot last couple of years now.
Yeah.
Devin, any itch to get on stage? Like,
no.
No, why?
I don't like being on stage.
Okay. What is it? Yeah, you want to make sure you're talking so the boys and the girls and the ladies and gentlemen home can be able to hear you. What is it like being backstage? And what is it like to get everything ready for the big night and then sit out in the audience? Do you actually get to watch one of the shows?
Usually.
Yeah.
See, the one who's not on stage. Usually. One word answers.
Yeah.
But she's, Devin, what was the last one you were at that I was in? Was that the Addams Family musical?
I think so.
About a year and a half ago. Milton did Addams Family the musical about a year and a half ago. And she and even her younger sister, who's now 8, and she still tells everyone she saw this. So it made a good impression, I guess. They got to see that. And Devin got to help build the set a little bit, too. Which is nice.
Build a set? So, like what's some of the things that you've been asked to do or complete or...
In the recent ones, there's a lot of just, like, screwing stuff together with, like, the wood to make, like, the platforms.
Wow. Yeah, she knows platforms. She knows framing. I'm trying to get a good life experience out of this. Someday she's going to redo my basement. She just doesn't know it yet.
Am I?
Now, see, instead of putting wood, we're going to do sheetrock.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same concept.
Very, very. And, you know what's funny is that I'm kind of reminiscing here is my fiancé's, her children... I would say the oldest wasn't into theater, but her middle daughter, wasn't so much someone who wanted to be on stage. She was behind the scenes and did set building and directing, choreography, and stuff like that. And then the younger one was on stage.
There we go. Sure.
So
it takes all kinds. I mean, we need everyone to do all these things. It's for better or worse, there are a million actors out there who all want to be on stage, but there are so many people who can do backstage stuff, and it's a specialty, and not everyone takes the time to learn it, and God forbid, not everyone takes the time to actually do it. So Milton Players, and actually any local community theater, is almost always looking for someone to help out, not just backstage, arranging everything. I mean, you need costumers, you need people to make costumes. Stage manager, set dressers.
Sure.
I mean, I've seen sets that look nicely built, but don't look lived in. I mean, this is someone's living room, say, and there are no tchotchkes or not even a lamp. Mm. You know, dumb things like that you need a set dresser for. Someone sit back and be like, what period is this? Oh, okay, well, I'll get you a couch that looks like that or this that brings out that period or what that person does for a living. Even Milton Players specifically, they do cabaret seating where you sit forward to a table and they pour wine and apple juice and water all night and you get cheese and crackers. They need people to...
Do that.
Yeah, do that. And you get to watch the show too. So you just pour some wine before the show during intermission and you get to sit at one of the tables yourself and just watch the show.
Now, you're not just somebody who's an actor. You're not somebody who's just in community theater, but you're involved even deeper than that, right? Aren't you a board member?
I have been a board member, yes. So Milton Players in particular, I've been with them on and off for, geez, maybe 13 years now, give or take. And
they can't get rid of you yet.
It was right after Devin was born, in fact. So, okay. Yeah, close to 13 years now. And what...
You drove him to theater.
Yeah.
Look what
right
you did.
Out of the house. I'm like, oh, baby, I got to do theater now. So I've been with them, and I've been a board member with them probably 10 out of the last 13 years or so. And we were fortunate to have a couple other people who were getting more and more involved with the group who can do what I've been doing for Milton. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to relax a little bit and enjoy some onstage time. But I still, like, we had set building the last 2 weekends. I was there 2 weekends ago, putting up the set, painting stuff, doing all the background stuff, which is always fun to do, too.
And... You're doing it all for, it's hitting the stage January 27th.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike.
That's right. Vanya.
And this is a Tony Award-winning comedy.
Indeed.
By Christopher Durang. Tell us the premise of the show.
Sure. Well, like I said, Tony Award-winning. Christopher Durang has written many, many plays. And I've actually been another one of his Beyond Therapy a few years ago with another group. And I love the way he writes. Everyone is zany, for lack of a better word. That's a fun word.
Used enough these days.
Not nearly enough. No. And, they all just do, but they're all very sincere, and they all have, they're not zany for the just to be zany. It's they're zany to an end. So in Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, there is the housekeeper named Cassandra, who's written after a Greek mythology character, and she has the gift of foresight, but no one will ever believe her. So she says, beware of this, beware of that, and people go, poof, and then it turns out, oh, we should have been aware of it.
This is Cassandra, right?
Yeah, Cassandra, exactly. And but she is, she comes out there and she'll go into a trance and she dances around and she tells her little prophecies and everything. But sometimes, you know, they're a little self-serving. So she'll tell you a vision, but then she'll say, oh, and you should do this because she needs you to do that, or do something else because she wants to get paid, or not cook lunch, or something like that. And basically, so she's not the only literary character. All these characters are from Chekhov plays, the Russian playwright. And it's actually one of the minor downsides of doing this play. Everyone hears Vanya and they go, oh, Uncle Vanya, that older play. No, the characters were kind of borrowed from it. The way Durang puts it is he kind of took all these characters and some of the plots and some of the settings, put them into a big blender, and just kind of spit out his own thing using all these different parts from Chekhov.
How interesting, it sounds as though you know Chekhov well. How, knowing these characters and how they've come out of the blender, give your thoughts on being a part of the show. And I believe that you are, your name is the top.
That's my character at the top. You're Vanya. Vanya. Yeah, it's awesome. Knowing Chekhov is a bluff. I have gotten to learn Chekhov, though.
Okay.
As I've gotten into this play, every now and then, you know, you're between things or whatever, you go to the Wikipedia, the Google, the whatnot, and I've been learning more and more about Chekhov and these characters and how different things are incorporated. My sister, Sonia, will just randomly start, she talks at one point about how she loves the wild turkeys that run about the property where they live, and she goes on how they are, they sleep in trees, but they fall out of them. And they're never quite at home, and they're never really doing what they should be doing. And she relates to that. So she just starts chanting randomly, I'm a wild turkey. I'm a wild turkey. And I forget where I was going with that. But yes, yeah, so it's that's part her zaniness, but part how she relates and expresses what she's going through. And it relates to her play, The Seagull, where she's originally from.
How important is it to come together as a cast and being able to be accurate to the show that won awards?
Well, you can, whenever you do a play, it's in your hands.
Right.
So you could, someone could
your
do
own spin.
Play. Exactly.
Depends on the director and the director's vision.
Exactly.
Right.
So you don't necessarily have to be sincere to the original production of it, but you do have to, whatever you decide the characters are, whatever you decide the setting is, and what angle you're coming at it from, you do have to be sincere to that. We aren't doing any, you know, outlandish spin on this, but we aren't necessarily trying to be the original characters. David Hyde Pierce was the original Vanya. I guess he and Christopher Durang went to school together back in the day, so they're kind of buddies. And a lot of Vanya's dialogue is written for David Hyde Pierce. If you're a fan of Frasier, if you're a fan of The Simpsons.
Frasier's brother,
and,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And Sideshow Bob's brother in The Simpsons.
Right.
And he just has this very elegant almost way of talking. And I spent a lot of time fighting that. Because I'm like, I don't want to. They would have hired David Hyde Pierce if they wanted David Hyde Pierce. But since so much of it is written kind of in his voice, you have to let it happen sometimes. And I'm not out there doing an impression of him. I'm doing my own thing. I've chosen a couple little physical and speech patterns and whatnot that are decidedly not him. And but I had to not fight it entirely, because that is part of the character. There are certain lines that are just going to come out sounding like him because they were written with him in mind.
Now, but I guess my question to you is trying to work with a cast, working together as a cast. I mean, here you are, you're a couple of weeks still away, but how are you guys bonding? Because I think every cast bonds differently.
Oh, exactly. I've been in some caustic casts too. Oh yeah. But this one's a nice.
So when you
cast.
Say caustic, mean there might be a diva or two within.
Oh,
or
exactly. Or every single one of them. I mean, yeah. Wow. There are some personalities. You don't get in the theater because you're a wallflower.
No. But personality is good. And
oh,
even,
sure.
Even if it is a little caustic,
it depends how they bring it. I mean, you could have a raving egomaniac, but if they bring whatever out with that, then that's great. One half is welcome with the other. Especially in a play like this, though, where it's a comedy and there's a lot of timing and we feed a lot off each other, you absolutely have to bond with the cast. Mm. Even if you're not out getting a beer every night with them and your buddies, you have to know them on stage, know what they're going to give you, know what you can play off of. And a comedy is a killer. I mean, you have to have the timing. You have to know what people are going to do, when they're going to do it, and how you can play off it.
What's your secret as an actor in being able to get your lines committed to memory as quick as possible? Everybody has a different trick.
Sure.
Do you write them out? Or are you somebody you just read them over and over and over? Do you listen to them? What do you do?
I tend to listen to them. Listen to them is my primary thing. So what I'll do is, since I have microphones around me all day long, at home I'll sit down and I'll record the script. I'll do everyone else's voices. I'll do my voice. I have a little MP3 plug in my car, the flash drive. So I just stick my thumb drive in the car, drive around all day. Devin hears it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Devin's tormented by
all
the
other voices. Like?
It literally scared me the first time I heard it. I had no idea what it was. It's some weird, almost lady voice talking.
Mm-hmm. Devin, is this audiobooks? Is this audiobooks? What is this?
And that's how it all starts. If I turn on the car and it's still playing the lines from when I was alone, she hears me trying to do one of the female voices. And it's scary. Sure.
Now, do you do two different versions? Do you do one version where you actually say, and do you do one where it's just other people's lines?
Or I never get around to the other version. Okay. I always mean to cut out my lines, but I just leave them there and I just talk over them. Okay. Which is good if you ever blank. I could just rewind it and I could still hear myself.
Okay, good. Yeah. Good to know. How are things coming along with this particular show? I mean, how close are you guys as far as with everything? Because again, it's right up to it, depending on how well you guys are working together, whether it's costumes, how far ahead the costumer is as far as getting everybody fitted and getting everything together.
I'd say with just about everything, we're like 85-90% of the way there, which is good. I've been in productions where you get ready too early and you lose some of that energy. Because, again, with comedies, there are laugh lines. And the director, the stage manager, they hear these lines once, twice, three times a week. And they stop laughing after a while. And you start wondering, is it me?
Oh, right.
And so if you're ready too early, you lose that energy. You forget, oh, no, this is actually a funny line. This is, you never know from audience to audience who's going to react to what.
And I was going to ask you that. Is what happens? What if the audience doesn't catch? What if you don't have a fast or a clever audience? Mm-hmm. Is it a matter of you push through it or do you wait for it?
And you got it. Yeah, you got to time it. You got to play it. You got to figure out and play by ear what's going to happen. I know there are a few lines that I'm like, oh, this is a killer, and I have built in my head a pause. But if I don't hear something immediately, you just got to jump right on the next thing. Exactly. There was a play I was in forever ago when I was younger. All my friends came to one night. So all my friends came to a Friday night, say. And everything I said gets a round of applause, and people are hooting and hollering because my buddies are out there. The next night, nobody. They're not there.
Nobody.
And I'm doing okay. I'm having an all right night. But everyone else in the cast gets in their minds that these are great pause, the great laugh lines, and they should pause. And it's crickets. Because they're nice lines, and they're probably being appreciated. But they're not the laugh out loud things my friends were giving me.
Okay.
So, yeah, you have to be on your toes. And you have to, as much as you want to be in the moment and with your fellow actor and with whatever character and all that you're developing, you do have to keep an ear out for the audience. So they might even laugh at unexpected things. And instead of charging through your line, you have to pause for a second and make it look natural that you're pausing, not just stopped cold for no apparent reason. Let them laugh, let them appreciate it, but then ride out that laugh and come in at a good point where you can keep everyone along with you.
Okay, we're speaking with Devin and Kevin Lowney, and we're talking a little bit about the Milton Players, Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike, and this is all hitting the stage January 27th, two weekends, 27th, 28th, Friday and Saturday nights, 8 p.m., and then the following weekend, the 3rd, the 4th, the 5th. Now, the 5th is actually a matinee, a 2 p.m. matinee. If you want to find out, if you want to order tickets, it's as easy as going online at MiltonPlayers.org, and it's at the Pappas Rehabilitation Hospital for Children, formerly known as, Kevin?
The Massachusetts Hospital School in Canton.
And this is the Brayton School Auditorium located in Canton, Massachusetts. And Kevin's giving us kind of the lowdown, a little bit of a preview of the show. And we want you to get tickets. If you're looking for something interesting, to do other than, you know, spending all kinds of money going to see Rogue One. You've seen it five times. Go see something different. Like,
Disney has all your money. Come to Milton Players.
All your money. The Milton Players. You want to see something. Community theater is where it's at. This is something that has been homegrown in your backyard. Mm. These people put it. They're not getting paid. They do. It's called community theater for a reason.
And the facilities are phenomenal, I have to admit. This place is a hidden gem. The current president, the current president came around right before the Milton Players needed a new home, mm-hmm. and he was very interested in getting a group in there to just use the space. It's phenomenal. Great wing space. The stage looks wonderful. Great seating. Parking right there on campus, which is a big step up from the place Milton Players used to have.
Free
parking.
Now, see, if you were to go into Boston.
Oh, forget it. Yeah.
And see a show, okay, you have to pay whatever it is.
At least $25.
At least $25, whatever parking garage you go into, mm-hmm. depending on how close you are to the garden, because it could be as much as like $30.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Why do that?
Exactly.
You stay local, mm-hmm. free parking, you get terrific performances. Mm-hmm. These are people who love what they do. And you get to see some of Devin's artwork.
That's right.
Yeah.
See that screw about 4 feet up? I put that there.
Devin did that. That flat, she held it in place.
I put that there.
That seam you can't see, Devin taped it.
Yeah.
Now, what's it like for you, Devin, to go and see a performance knowing that you helped cultivate the set that your dad and some of the folks I'm sure that you know are performing upon?
I feel pretty proud of myself, usually.
There we go.
There you go. Anything that we haven't touched upon in regards to this particular performance that's coming up?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I should mention the plot just a little bit, too, because I'm touching a bit of it. Vanya and Sonia have, they're both in their mid-50s, say, and they've grown up in this house. They stayed there caring for their elderly parents as they ended up with Alzheimer's, dementia, ended up passing away. But Masha, their older sister, is a Hollywood star. She's been out there. She's made, what do they call it? The Sexy Killer movies. It's a five-part movie series she's been in.
Like a Nightmare on Elm Street type of thing.
Basically,
right,
yeah. Right, sure. So she knows she's not maybe the hottest actress ever, but she knows she's a global celebrity. Everyone, she walks down the street, people
they
recognize
her.
So she's had this incredibly glamorous life, while the other two basically just got caught up in taking care of the parents and haven't moved on. They've been sitting there in the house with each other for the better part of the past decade. And there's a wonderful scene about three quarters of the way through the movie, the play, between Sonia and Masha, where Sonia says, "You've been out gallivanting the world. You've been having a brilliant life, enjoying yourself, and we've been stuck here." And Masha goes, "That's what I did for work." Masha was out there. It looked like she was having fun, but she was paying for the house. She was paying for the parents' care. She's sending stipends back for her brother and sister to be able to live, to take care of these the parents and everything. And she's still doing it years after the parents have passed away. And it's this great scene where they say, look, there are two sides to this. It's not me abandoning you. It's not you not pulling your weight. There's all sorts of wonderful duplicity to everything.
How much are tickets?
Tickets are $20 a piece. Okay. That gets you a seat, gets you your free parking, and you get, as I mentioned earlier, wine and cheese.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Just one, is it like American cheese?
It is, it's kind of like pub cheese.
So they would just kind of throw that
throw
out
it
there.
Yeah, just throw it out there. It's a nice spread cheese. So you get the whole bunch of crackers, you did the crackers and the cheese. Larry knows what we're talking about. Oh, and Christine, oh, you heard cheese, Christine? I can't hear
she
you.
Did hear, she did hear, she did hear cheese.
You want my, what's that, Christine? I should not mind it. You want my free ticket, Christine? You can come. No. I'll bring back some of the cheese, though, if I can.
She's a theater person herself, so she understands. she does. Absolutely.
Freebies is a big deal.
But we want to thank you for coming in. What is the next after Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike?
Yes, so immediately after this closes, Milton Players is auditioning for Dial M for Murder.
Ooh.
Classic movie, great Ooh. Play, very dark, very mysterious, a lot of tension. And that is going up, oh my goodness, in June, I believe.
Okay.
And yeah, and that'll round out our season.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's almost over. Now, are you having folks audition? Are you going to have an audition date?
Yes. It is. I wish I had it in front of me, but I believe it's the weekend after we wrap, so the weekend of the 6th, of February 6th. You can not only on MiltonPlayers.org, but you can find Milton Players on Facebook, too.
Yeah, and I think I might have said MiltonPlayers.com earlier. And
.org, yes.
MiltonPlayers.org. Ticket information, if you want to find out about what some of the stuff that they are working on, you want to find out more about this particular performance, if you want to order tickets, MiltonPlayers.org. Easiest way to do it. Again, it's free parking, mm-hmm. $20 a ticket. Mm-hmm. It's that easy, and you get to see some of Devin's handiwork, as well as some fine folks who work behind the scenes to make all of this possible.
Indeed.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and giving us a little bit of a preview of this upcoming performance of Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
And
thanks.
She's so shy. That's all the Monday Night Talk that we have until next week at 6:15 p.m. Have yourself a great evening.
Woo! Woo!